You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to all, and you're really hardcore enthusiasts. Because after three tiring days and with all the sun that's out there, but we have a superstar here, the Secretary General of the OECD, Angel Gurría, and a topic which is, you know, very, very important and close to our hearts. As you, most of you know, he was a very important minister in Mexico, first the debt negotiator. I met him first at that time. Don't ask how many years ago. And then, of course, finance minister and many other positions, but now he is Secretary General of the OECD, has reformed the OECD, restructured, strengthened it quite a bit. And, you know, there's this ranking of think tanks in the world. I'm very happy that OECD is an international organization and not a think tank. Because thanks to that, Brookings gets ranked, a lot of the times as the best think tank. So thankfully we're not in competition. But I think the...
We're a do tank.
That's right. But the amount of analytical work done at the OECD and the thinking on really the very big important issues is really quite impressive. And the fact that it's often done in a very collaborative way without, you know, the kind of problems of conditionality and adversary type of relation that sometimes arise when there's lending involved, I think that makes the OECD intellectually all the more influential. So thank you, Angel, for being here. And the issue of growth and income distribution, the degree of inclusiveness, what one really means, what the data really show, I think it's probably one of the two or three really big issues today in global economics and in global politics. So I really look forward to your presentation, and then I will have the privilege to have a discussion with you.
Thank you very much, especially on a Friday afternoon, and on a lovely Friday afternoon, by the way. President Kennedy once said that the rising tide lifts all the boats, this famous phrase now. But now, across the world, or at least very large parts of the world, the last three decades have seen the tide of growth lift a lot of yachts. But the rafts of the poorest really were stuck in the mud. Not a good state of things. Let me give you a few numbers to just spell out exactly what I mean. Across the 34 advanced economies that make up the OECD, roughly 50% of the world's GDP and shrinking, the average income of the richest 10% is now almost 10 times that of the poorest 10%. Yeah, so what? You know, you here have been listening to the 1% and the 0.1% and all these numbers, you know. But this is a very traditional measure. 10% against the 10%. How many times does the income of the poorest fit into the income of the richest? Well, 10 times. So what? Well, problem. 25 years ago, it was 7 times. It is growing very fast, going in exactly the wrong direction, but the speed is quite amazing. Now, the crisis, of course, accelerated that. In the first 3 to 4 years of the crisis, inequality grew faster than in the 12 years before the crisis. So, nothing like a good crisis to exacerbate inequality, and we had it as good as they come. Now, inequality has risen even in traditionally egalitarian countries, Norway, Sweden. The situation in emerging markets and developing countries even worse. 50 times in Brazil, 30 times in Mexico, 100 times in South Africa. But you lose track. You know, there comes a moment when the numbers don't have a very great meaning. It's simply that it just shows that the inequalities are absolutely abysmal. And one then understands better why it is that some of the social tensions get out of hand. Inequality is also a burning issue here in the United States. This is a country founded on egalitarian principles, a nation known as the land of hope, a land of opportunity, a place where some smarts and a lot of hard work would get you to be, Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or the American dream. Yet today, even as the U.S. continues to lead the recovery from the Great Recession, there is a nagging sense that things are not getting better for everyone as wealth and opportunity become disproportionately concentrated in the hands of those at the top. This is borne out in the data. 30 years ago, the average income of the top 10% was 12 times higher than the bottom 10%. Today, that's 16 and a half times. Again, you're looking at a 30% increase, 30, 35% increase, whatever. Very large numbers, very fast. What is more, those at the very top are doing even better. And then you go into the 0.1 and the things that Oxfam came out with recently, you know, this 0.1% in the U.S. currently lay claim to 8% of the national pre-income tax. Now, to put that in perspective, that's twice the share of their equivalents in Canada or the U.K. or Switzerland. And this gives the U.S. the dubious honor of being some way out in front as the most unequal among the rich countries, I have to say, because the inequality numbers, as I said, in developing countries get very, very large. But in the rich countries, or among the rich countries, the U.S. has perhaps a gold medal it would not want to have. Now, the OECD numbers tell a clear-cut story how our traditional economic growth agenda has neglected inclusiveness. Yet to begin to tackle the problem, we have to understand that inequality is not just about money. It touches every area of people's lives. Take education for an example. Right across the OECD, children from poor families are more likely to attend substandard schools than their wealthier peers. Intuitively, not surprising. But this has practical consequences. This initial disadvantage follows them and may end up with lower paid jobs. In the U.S., around 15% of the variation in student performance is explained by socioeconomic background. Now, what does this complex construction mean? It means simply poor families, poor students, poverty perpetuates. The best educational systems are the ones who break the linkage between the socioeconomic backgrounds of the families and the performance of the children in standardized tests or any kind of test or simply in the regular curriculum in schools. The opposite perpetuates the socioeconomic vulnerabilities of the families. To make matters worse, life expectancy in OECD countries is correlated with education. Our data show that at age 30, those with the lowest levels of education are, on average, expected to live 6 years less than their well-educated counterparts. Talk about practical consequences. Here in the U.S., the most well-educated white males are expected to live as many as 14 years longer than the most poorly educated African-American males. This is first and foremost a profound social tragedy, no doubt, but also has severe economic consequences. Evidence suggests that when rising inequality perpetuates exclusion, it leads to poorer economic performance. Recent OECD research estimates that rising inequality has knocked off as much as 7 percentage points of the cumulative GDP growth in the U.S. since 1990. So, let's say, you know, 1990 to 2010, the GDP is, let's say, 100. Well, it would be 107 were it not for the inequality. It's slightly better than Mexico, the UK, or Norway, you know, because, again, in these cases, the inequality is producing even larger drops of GDP. But it still amounts to well over $1 trillion of lost output. What are we, 15, 16 billion, roughly, a trillion, the U.S.? So take off a trillion, 7%. That's the size of the impact of inequality. And that can be traced directly to the families with lower incomes slipping behind because they underinvest in education and in skills. So there you have the connection. Inequality has also imposed a cost on our democracies, hitting trust and hitting civic engagement. Across the OECD, the percentage of people who trust their governments slumped to 42% last year. Hardly a rave review of an inclusive political process. Now, clearly, something should be done. I can tell you from my own experience, governments right across the world are waking up to the dangers of growing unequal. Just last month, I was in Beijing. I launched, among others, a report on inclusive growth in China. This is at the request of the Chinese authorities, by the way, of the NDRC, which is the utmost, you know, planning institution, which combines both the technical as well as the political levels. And now, the government is planning to use this in the elaboration of the 13th five-year plan. And they asked us to go with it and produce a full economic report, a report about urbanization, a report about what I call GPS, which is China in the world, and you know, how to do better, how to be very good citizens. They are going to be hosting, by the way, or presiding over the G20 next year. And they are preparing. We are training some of their people. We had very interesting seminars in Beijing. They're coming, and they're going to be embedded in our own directorates in order to train in the special areas in which they're going to be working with the G20. But, you know, they said, the other one was, they said, please write one about inclusive growth. Interesting. Today, many countries from Sweden to Korea, New Zealand, are talking about how to tackle inequalities as an urgent priority. So what about action? We believe we can help. We just launched our inclusive growth initiative, and we call it All on Board, Making Inclusive Growth Happen. It sets out to support member countries in turning inclusiveness into a fundamental driver of growth. It builds on some of the lessons we have learned over two decades of analyzing and assessing inequalities. And as Kemal here, who is, by the way, a very dear and distinguished member of the advisory group, the advisory that is of the inclusive growth work. As he can attest, the results of our work have shown that there doesn't have to be a trade-off between growth and equality. On the contrary, if you want sustainable long-term economic growth, then you need policies that include all members of society, especially the most disadvantaged. Now, this flagship report and the work that it has already spawned, it's having children, you know, it's generating now. We're mainstreaming this inclusive growth in a lot of the work that we're doing now, so that it's not just one report separate from everything else, but rather part of the way in which of the method with which we approach, part of NAIC, you know, the new approaches to economic challenges that we're doing at the at the OECD. This is part of that. Sets out a number of areas where governments can make a difference to promote inclusive growth. And let me share a few of them with you because they're particularly relevant to the U.S. First, there's a real need to ensure that everyone, regardless of wealth, race, creed, or gender, has access to high-quality education and training opportunities throughout their lives. Now, as you know, the OECD has this program called PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment. We normally roll it out of Washington, by the way. Arne Duncan has asked us already twice, and he asked us again to do it next year, because next year is when we report. This year we're going to be crunching out the numbers, 2015. We get the information. All of next year we spent working on the numbers and the conclusions and the analysis. At the end of next year, in December, we roll it out. And Arne has already asked us to, Secretary Duncan, to please come and do it again out of the U.S. because he says, you know, this continues to be a wake-up call. President Obama, when we presented this for the first time, he said it was a Sputnik moment because they saw that the U.S. was kind of in the middle and a little lower than the middle. And, of course, you were spending like three times more than the average. He said, it was interesting. We, Slovakia and ourselves more or less are on the same level. Problem is we spend three times more per student than Slovakia. So, you know, why is that? Good question. And, of course, we've been working with them to see if we could do better. Now, this PISA underlines that excellence through equity is possible. Experience from the Nordic countries, Singapore, Shanghai, suggests that expanding low-income families' access to high-quality preschools makes a difference, starting with preschool. And then, of course, all through the, what I would call the knowledge chain, you know, just like the global value chains, the education chain. In the U.S., the plan for early education for all Americans is a crucial step in this direction, and efforts to that effect should continue. Second, job policies aimed at bringing disadvantaged groups into employment can also promote growth overall. Measures to help women better reconcile their work and their family lives will be key to creating an economy where everyone can make ends meet. Such measures could take many forms, but granting access to paid family leave nationally and expanding access to quality early childhood care would be an important start. Third, health. Health is intimately linked with income and employment. Making health insurance coverage universal is essential to reducing health inequalities. Yet the most vulnerable also need additional attention from policymakers to compensate for bad health outcomes and non-financial barriers to health care. I have to say we were very early proponents and supporters of the health care bill that the President of the United States introduced. We are on record, we came to the Senate, we supported it, and of course we know that this is very sensitive and got extremely political after that, and it still is. But this is a very, very important element of the inclusive growth story for the United States. Finally, governments could do more to raise incomes for those on low wages by expanding the earned income tax credit or putting in place higher minimum wages. More generally, there's ample scope for wide-ranging reforms of tax and transfer systems that would not blunt incentives to work, save, or invest. We believe that, for example, going to the minimum wage that is being proposed at 10-10 is something which would be desirable, would provide a minimum of protection for the more vulnerable of the workforce, and at the same time would, of course, prop up demand. It would reduce poverty, and last but not least, to the extent that these would become formal jobs, it creates a greater loyalty between the firms and the workers, which acts both ways, because the workers will be more willing to go the extra mile for the firm, and the firm, of course, will be more willing to invest in the workers' skills. And skills, not just education, but skills, is the critically important element for productivity and competitiveness. And the U.S. came out bad on the skills test. It is fascinating. We tested on the skills to match the needs of the market. The Japanese came out on top, but they didn't perform very well. Why? The UK, the US came out pretty close to the bottom. This was just 24 countries that we did, all of them OECD. But they came out much better on productivity. Well, the thing is, the system, your very competitive system, squeezes every drop out of whatever skills people have. And therefore, somebody with less skills will be more productive than somebody who has more skills, but is, let's say, in the Japanese system, where the demands on them with, you know, teamwork and relatively well-structured hours and stuff like that, and where it is not necessarily expected that you go the extra mile in order to prove that you are probably better than the others, and actually not, the contrary. It would be, stay with the group, and, you know, but it's a different culture. It has nothing to do with whether it's better or worse. It's a different culture. It allows you to get away with less skills. The problem is, imagine what they could do with a little bit more of a competitive environment in the workplace, and what you could do with more skills. You know, it'd be a very nice combination of comparative advantages. So, dear friends, Kamal, Colin, your friend Sergio, so many good friends that I see, we can no longer afford to think about growth and inclusiveness as if they were separate, or even worse, as if they were opposite concepts. The real test of a healthy economy is not the extent to which it empowers those at the top to expand their fortunes, but rather the chances it bestows on those at the bottom to create their own fortune. Thank you very much.
Give you officially.
And at my speech. The words of wisdom. So I got the mic.
Good.
Come out. Can I just take 1 minute? Oh, I'm wired. Just one little moment. Society at a Glance, 2014. Closing the Gender Gap, subtitle, Act Now. What they told me when they saw this is, they said, it's a very appropriate cover. The women look very determined. They know what they're doing, and the men don't really know where they're going. Trends in income inequality and its impact on economic growth. This is the one that says increase in the Gini will produce decrease in GDP. And this is all on board, making inclusive growth happen in China. This is the one I told you about. It really exists. We really delivered it to the Chinese. It really exists. It's there. This is the latest about our economic projections. And last but not least, going for growth, which is structural measures, not fixing the budget, not fixing the inflation, not fixing the interest rates, but basically medium and long-term measures. So now you thought you'd get in away with only that little one. Now you get, there you are. Okay. Now you wire me up again. So now... Harold White, yes. Pass muster now. Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you.
Again, this was a great presentation, and it covered a lot of ground, really, you know, from facts to policy prescriptions, and really congratulations. It's the work of, you know, the OECD that's been going on for quite a while, but particularly strong, I think, the last 2-3 years. I mean, the first question I have is, if you look at the kind of sweep of history, and, you know, of course, you didn't mention the bestseller, Thomas Piketty, but it comes kind of a little bit from his historical story, which is a story, you know, backed up by some numbers, but it's not, not every country follows that story. But there is this kind of this long-term cycle that I think is fairly well established, that there was an increase in inequality in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and particularly after the First World War in the 1920s, up to the Great Depression. And then from the Great Depression, and particularly from World War II, which was an equalizer for many OECD countries, a very, you know, cruel, and certainly we don't want that kind of equalizer, but there was a movement towards more equality, particularly in the U.S., starting with the Roosevelt's programs and the 50s and the 60s. And then a reversal, and we're now back to the inequality levels in the U.S. that, or even above them, that were reached in the 1920s. In Europe, it's not quite the same, but the crisis seems to have pushed Europe towards more inequality. China has developed very high levels of inequality. I guess Latin America is the only continent where there seems to be a fairly consistent decrease, but from very high levels. So do you have any thoughts on why there have been these cycles?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that we invited Thomas Piketty when he had just published in French. And I remember that, you know, we have an auditorium. It's about 130, 150 people. And we had to get, you know, tell them, come on, guys, you know, get your staff. And, you know, it's because I don't want empty rooms, you know. It's a little embarrassing for our guests, you know. So we had to kind of get people into the room and encourage them to join. So he said, he did his stuff, you know, and he said this. And then a few months later, he got this translated into English, and then he did his famous road tour, in the U.S. And then he became a rock star. He said, Toma, come on, come back again. And this time, when we started taking reservations, we stopped at 800 because, you know, and then we had standing room only. We probably had about 9. We had more people than with Angela Merkel, you know? It was quite fantastic. So it just shows you how a particular idea whose time has come. Now, I connect this with the fact that we really did not come out of this the last 2 or 3 years. Effectively, we started working, like, you know, more than 10 years ago, 12, 15 years ago. And then by the time we realized how potentially big this could be, we published our first magna opus, besides a number of papers, and in 2008, and it was called Growing Unequal? And unfortunately, 3 years later, we removed the question mark. And then we call it Divided We Stand. You know, it was obviously an allusion to the hymn about United We Stand. But the subtitle said, Why Inequality Keeps Growing. That was in the thick of the crisis. And we're now about to put out, in the next few weeks, the next one, which basically tracks the inequality issue to the labor market. And to this question about education, the question of skills, the question of the perpetuation of the disadvantages of families because they underinvest in education or in two systems of health where there has to be a lot of co-payments and there have to be, you know, and people have to pay for their medicines or part of it, whatever that. So you basically really are talking about the level playing field or not. So back to your own question, I think it has to do with the fact that governments who became more convinced that it was good economics to be compassionate have done better. And governments who thought that it was best left to the market and let the market, you know, decide who's going to be the winner, who's going to be the loser, and, well, you know, provide some kind of general safety net, but not an enormously expensive well, what happened then is that you had these models which became cliches. It became a cliche that in the U.S. you got a pink slip. And in Denmark, you also got a pink slip. Very flexible labor markets. But you immediately got caught by the, got saved, got picked up by the public safety net. Whereas in the United States, you got your pink slip, thank you very much. But you also crossed the street and got another job, which you wouldn't do in Europe. So this was the caricature until the crisis. Where it happens that in the U.S. you can no longer cross the street with your pink slip. In fact, you stay with your pink slip, and then you end up applying for unemployment benefits for another month, for another two, for another three. And in some states, you remember how it was managed, up to 2 years. I mean, 2 years. Here was 3 months. And in Europe, where you can be a professional unemployed, in fact, you can move from university to being an unemployed and stay like that. Because some of these are national systems are designed in a way which is they create a disincentive to actually find a job, particularly if you're not very well qualified. And then what happens is that it became impossible to pay. The system was going to, you know, go bankrupt. So then you start adjusting the age of retirement, contributions, benefits, the very expensive and politically sensitive issue of health systems. And the also very sensitive and politically almost explosive system of education, access. Access, quality, bang for the buck. You know, both in health and education. Access, quality, bang for the buck. So these things explain, you know, the cultures have been now cultures that have been different in terms of the priorities and what you were after. And this was based not on the fact that they were ruthless or the leaders were ruthless or they were careless or were not sensitive. It was based on the conviction that, again, a rising tide will lift all the boats. That if you had growth, it was going to take care. Somehow it's going to take care of everybody. And then you get a little more granular, a little more granular, and then a little more granular, and then you see, no, it won't. And that's because some of them are anchored to the bottom. Because they do not have the skills, because they do not have the education, because, sometimes simply they don't have enough health to do the job, whatever. And so you then you find out the differences, and then you see the results. And what is happening? Well, frankly, there is a very clear convergence. Europe is less protective in the sense of even generating excessive, protective legislation for the workers, becoming more flexible, and the United States becoming more so, because it had nothing. So now, minimum wages. Germany just got its minimum wage, 850 euros per hour. We were very supportive of the minimum wage. Some people in the government were not amused. By that time, of course, they already had a coalition, and one of the members of the coalition were the socialists, who were very supportive of the senior members of the coalition were the CDU, and they were not tremendously amused by the idea of a minimum wage. But the fact of the matter is, it had not been necessary to have a minimum wage in Germany until we found out that it was necessary. Why? Because we suddenly erase the proverbial, perfect, exemplary society with, all the flexibility. You got less lower unemployment than before the crisis and all that stuff. And you suddenly see that you had very precarious wages. And some people were in very vulnerable positions. In fact, a few million. Well, over here, what's the calculation? More than 20 million could benefit from the workforce could benefit from a minimum wage. Walmart just went to $9, right?
Not the exact figure.
They're not trying to establish a minimum wage for the country, but they went to $9 instead of 7 foot or whatever it was. I don't think they were at the minimum anyway, but this is kind of, it's dawning on. In Japan, last week, 10 days ago, whatever, there was a big negotiation between the large enterprises with the unions, with Rengo, with the union, big union confederation. And they're going to have 2.3% real increase. Basically because they had 2.3% nominal and inflation went to zero. They're not happy with zero. They like to have more, but it went to zero after the oil dropped. So it was kind of a good zero, as opposed to the ones that are produced by low demand. So what happens? Well, you are seeing a reconsideration of the fact that it needs to have a well-remunerated or a better remunerated workforce in order for the whole of the economy to work better, rather than continuing to just increase the differences between the remuneration to capital and the remuneration to the workforce.
Well, that's an optimistic view in a way, because, as you said, in Europe, perhaps there was too much inflexible protection in most places, and in the U.S. not enough. But let me question a little bit on the U.S. side. It's true the healthcare bill, which passed with a lot of trouble, has a redistributive effect that's quite clear. Yeah, and hopefully it won't be revoked, although it's not, it's not yet fully clear what will happen in the future, right? With a Congress that is now totally, both chambers are against it. On the minimum wage, it's being talked about, but it hasn't happened yet. And there's a strong opposition to it. And I would argue that on education, compared to 20, 25 years ago, if anything, the direction has been in the opposite direction. I mean, the cost, the quality difference between low-income, the kind of education that low-income people can afford and get through the public system, and the education that the rich are able to afford has, if anything, increased. College costs have gone through the roof. There is a
I think, $1 trillion of student debt. And it is increasingly much more than in the past the case that the rich have much better and easier access to top education. So I'm not quite sure that, you know, in the US the direction is really what you say, frankly. And I want to link it to another question, which has to do with the top 1% issue, more than with the top 10%. And that is the tremendous political clout that money can buy in the US. With Supreme Court decisions that have basically abolished all limits, and you don't even have to identify yourself. And obviously this gives the people who are very wealthy and a lot of money the kind of financial power in the political process to influence it to a very great degree. Now, there are other things at work too, the internet, the grassroots mobilization, and maybe there's an argument that it's not that important. But the degree, the power of financial lobbying and of money in politics, again, has increased. And because of the extremely wealthy position of the top 1%, it is quite natural that they will channel the legislative process in their favor. Today, there's a $5 million exemption to inheritance tax. I don't know what's in Mexico or in France or whatever, but, you know, to say that even if you think that money is made by skill, but to then allow the rich to leave more than $5 million to their kids, and there are all kinds of loopholes that can make it as big as 10, 20, and whatever. You know the Warren Buffett statement that his secretary was paying more taxes as a share of income than himself. So anyway, all this makes me kind of question your optimistic assessment that there is that convergence. And in Europe, sure, the degree of protection was, you know, was sometimes excessive, but income distribution was more equal. But now I have the feeling that everywhere, including in Sweden, certainly in the crisis countries, certainly in Spain, inequality is actually increasing quite rapidly. So somehow I feel that the picture is not quite as positive and easy as I understood some of your remarks.
Okay. I think it's very fair. And second, perhaps I should have been clear in the sense that all the things I said have to do with the policies that we believe should be put in place in order to address this. But we've also seen how this has happened in practice. I mean, here you did not have Obamacare and you'd had no care. You had 45 million Americans without care, period. Now they got a shot at it, even if the, you know, every judge and every whatever are fighting it, and the partisans and the Republicans and the Supreme Court, whatever. I think we won at the Supreme Court at the first round of the fight, at least. And I say we because, as I said, we came here to support it. We believe that in the United States, how is it possible that 15% of the population simply did not have any kind of protection? And I remember, you know, having some rather exalted, learned representative of the United States government in the OECD saying, this is what the Americans choose to have. Therefore, don't give us a hard time saying, you know, because we were trying to analyze the comparative, you know, systems and see who did what and which was better outcomes. And we couldn't even discuss the health system of any country because we were blocked. At the committee level, at the OECD, we couldn't think. We're told not to think, you know. Now, this was before I got there, and we started to think and raised a few eyebrows and irked a few people and whatever. But now we're full speed ahead because, of course, the government changed and there was less resistance to that. But I have to say that You are right in the sense that if you look at the processes, you know, overall, you say, well, it's not. For example, you know, Mr. Spriggs here will be my witness about the fact that we've discussed this. And let's increase productivity because productivity will allow us to increase wages and will, you know, to increase competitiveness, et cetera. He says, in the United States, we've doubled productivity in the last 25, 30 years. And, of course, wages have continued to come down. So I have to say this is true in the United States, but it is not in the other, you know, in many of the other countries. In the other countries, mostly if you increase productivity. In fact, the reason why many of all of these countries are in deep trouble is because their productivity has flattened or fallen in the last 15 years. It's not from the crisis. And so they've lost ground, they lost competitiveness, they lost everything in the, and they're trying to catch it back. And but in the case of the United States, yes, there are. I think there are very important institutional, cultural, some historical, traditional, social constraints that go beyond simply the question of the relationship between wages and production, how much, you know, you produce in 1 hour or in 1 day. And it deserves maybe focusing on that. But I would say generally, what you have is broad brushstrokes. Is you have, first of all, a much greater awareness of the issues. I mean, inclusive growth used to be like kind of a group of people who were considered like quixotic or something like that, you know. And now it's mainstream. Now you call it shared prosperity at the World Bank, and you call it whatever you go. I think even the IMF has a particular name for inclusive growth. And everybody is kind of in the business of looking about fighting inequality, let's say. Okay, the president of the United States calls it the defining issue. Now, you can't call the enemy the defining issue if you don't say what you're going to do about it. And the answer to inequality is inclusive growth. And what are you doing about it? Well, you're making it a little better, you know, for the education, access, quality, bang for the buck, health, access, quality, bang for the buck, and training, skilling. Skilling is so important. Skills is a kind of combination of education, labor markets, vocational training, on-the-job learning, and it is an absolutely critical element of productivity and competitiveness in any. We mentioned a moment ago the differences between the U.S. and the U.K. and some of the Europeans, etc. But these are the things that today we know can address at least some of the broader manifestations of the question of inequality and that are going in the right direction. The other question is the constraints. You can't throw money at this thing, or at least you can't throw all the money you would need to grow, especially for those systems that have been neglected for some time, simply because there isn't the money, or at least the money is being allocated to things that at this stage would probably should not have the same priority because these are the priorities.
Anya, let me break in there and then I will turn to the... You actually at the OECD have done work. You didn't mention this, but I know you've... I mean, I've been at the London G20 meeting where your, you know, work on tax evasion was center, you know. I also know you're doing work on tax base shifting, because there are two issues with taxes. One is illegal evasion, but quantitatively, the much bigger issue is that many corporations can perfectly legally not pay taxes. When Jeff Immelt was named by President Obama key business advisor, there was the embarrassing situation that a week later, the story came out that General Electric had paid no corporate income tax in the United States. And when you say there's no money, part of the reason there's no money...
Yeah, that's true.
And you, I mean, so
I mean, come on, this is so true. The crisis left us a legacy of slow growth or negative growth, of higher unemployment, of growing inequalities. But then because of all the three above, of a very serious erosion of trust. And why is the trust? Well, first, people don't pay taxes who should. What is the exchequer left with if the large guy, the large companies don't pay taxes and the richer people don't pay taxes? The middle class, the small and medium enterprises, how much can you tax them more and more and more until there comes a moment when it's not efficient and you run them out of business or whatever? Well, I just came. The last thing we talked about at the G20 meeting an hour ago, 2 hours ago, was about the tax. Automatic exchange of tax information for individuals. And BEPS, base erosion and profit shifting, which you referred to in a moment. For what? Precisely in order to make ends meet. Why? Because we already said monetary policy to fight the crisis. We're at zero interest rates. How further down can you go? Well, some Nordic countries are trying negative, but basically you're trying to put the money with the banks and make them lend the money and or give a lot of people their money so that they can spend it rather than save it. But it means we've been there and done that. Second is spend. Government spend more. Well, sorry, been there, done that, increased by 30 to 40% debt to GDP ratios. In fact, now I'm trying to reduce the deficit and reduce the debt. So what are you left with? Structural, you know, education, innovation, regulations, product markets, all these things that we talked about a moment ago. You know, these are the kinds of things. But the trust comes from the fact that people don't pay taxes, that the services are not of good enough quality, and also corruption, the perception of corruption or sheer incompetence that is not sanctioned. Corruption has a particularly corrosive, and people have much less and less tolerance about corruption. And we've seen now many examples in some large emerging economies and even in some important developed economies. So when you're talking about taxes, Kemal, you're talking about one of the huge pending tasks. And one, let me tell you, when you're talking about people paying taxes, you're talking about enforcing the existing laws. When you're talking about multinationals paying taxes, you're talking about massive changing of the laws.
And internationally coordinated.
In an internationally coordinated fashion, which is what we're doing with the BEPS project, the most ambitious ever restructuring of the international tax laws.
Okay, we'll go to some questions now. We'll take a few. And the lady there on the right, yeah?
Thank you. Puma Kimis from OMFIF. I have two questions for you. The first is on apprenticeships. Now, we have seen the UK, we've seen Germany really improving their competitiveness based on historical apprenticeships. Is this the main route of prizing open the Gordian knot between inequality and competitiveness? And secondly, the IMF managing directorship role is coming up for grabs in the next couple of, well, year and a half or so. Would we be expecting someone with the initials of AG running for such a role? Or, and secondly, what
Alan
sort of...
Alan Greenspan is not interested.
Indeed. Age does play a factor,
he told me
of
that.
Course. And also, what sort of characteristics would you expect for the managing director? Thank you.
First of all, if you ask me, we have a very good one now.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah, we'll take a few.
Okay, we'll take a few.
Yes, Teresa?
A couple of things. First of all, You have spoken very much about rising inequality in market incomes, and there is no question that that's happening. Is this true also for disposable incomes of households? What do the statistics show on that? Because ultimately, that's probably a better indicator of welfare than spending power and so on. And the second is a question about the minimum wage. I mean, I agree with you very much that, in a country like this, clearly the minimum wage has been kept for too long at unchanged in nominal terms, and this has deleterious effect on income inequality. But I also have seen countries like Brazil where, for instance, the minimum wage has been raised far too fast, to be sort of sustainable in light of developments in productivity. And, I mean, you come from a country where, informality is so prevalent. Does your prescription apply equally to countries where a sharp increase in the minimum wage could lead to increased informality?
Okay, and one gentleman there would just raise his hand. Right.
Hi. So my question is,
identify yourself.
My name is Metin Toksozaksa. I'm a student at American University. My question is a follow-up to Mr. Darvish's question. You have seen a lot of opposition at the national level in the U.S. for a lot of the reforms you're talking about. Do you have any suggestions for reforms that states could make? Because a lot of people see that as a more realistic approach. Thank you.
Okay, one more. How am I going to choose? I think you were the first there to.
Thank you. I'm Jeff Wheeler from the Department of Labor. One issue I'm wondering about is the imbalance of power, both political power and economic power, and how that plays into the growing inequality. For example, it's very expensive to run for office. It takes a lot of money. And the second is the lack of organized power from workers. So it's not just about the minimum wage, but whether there are unions that are able to represent and negotiate higher wages.
Okay, Angel.
Okay. Apprenticeships and wages, is this the magic wand, No, but it helps. Actually, it helps quite a bit. And let me tell you, for a moment there, the word apprenticeship was being bandy around as if it were some kind of panacea for the labor market, and everybody there were charter planes going to Germany to see how these guys did it. Let me tell you about apprenticeships. Imagine that instead of this very rigid situation that you have now, you have what some countries have, which is an apprenticeship system where the entry wage is even lower than the minimum wage, and then you start going up the ladder, you go through the minimum wage, as you get more qualified, you get paid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is institutionalized, and that allows companies to test very freely and very openly the fact that they'd like to hire people, and this way they discover, and then they train them also in the process, which means they upskill, and then they get loyalty to the company. Company gets loyal to them. You have a minimum of guarantees. This is not, the dual labor market today of some with every protection and then some with no protection whatsoever. You get, of course, a minimum with Social Security, whatever, and yes, it can work. The problem is it needs a culture. And it needs a cooperation between the government, the companies, the unions, and, of course, the individual workers to understand that this is the way it's going to work. And it also needs for cultures to understand that not everybody can go to university or should go to university, but that there are different ways. And then you can go through an apprenticeship system, and then you have to have the necessary flexibility for those who have the ambition and the talent to move to the more formal type of education once they've been in the apprenticeship. So yes, I give it a very great merit. But again, it's not going to happen everywhere. And it's also linked to wages, because the apprenticeship system typically is linked to more flexible wage systems. In terms of what you asked about the IMF, I think they have a fine managing director. I didn't even know that it was coming up for. But it does, you know, this.
It's not. It's two years.
Yeah, it's 2 years. So I wasn't aware of this discussion. But I think they have a fine managing director. On the question of the difference, Teresa, between nominal and disposable incomes, one of the features of the taxing systems of countries like Latin American countries is that, you know, you have your inequalities in Europe, in the United States, and in Latin America, let's say, okay, the three. And then you apply your taxes, and you apply your social securities, and you bring in the benefits, and then let's say you reduce by one half the inequalities, by one third in the other case, and by like zero in Latin America. Why? Well, because you don't collect the taxes, because the wealthiest don't pay the taxes, because the state is... I'm going to talk about my own country. It has the smallest budget. I mean, the other day I was in Indonesia last week, and I was telling them, "Do you realize how small your government is?" And I said, "I'd never going to catch myself saying something like that anywhere." So they'd say that a country has a small government, that they should increase the number of officials. But of course, this is a country that has 17,000 islands and 240 million people. And it should have more people to take care of the people. You know, it has a very small budget and a very small government. Well, my country, without the oil, would be in the teens. The size of the government would be maybe one third of that average for the OECD, half of what it is in Brazil, maybe, or less. So basically, the disposable income has to do with these institutions like the taxation system and how well it works, and basically the fact that, you know, Chile famously unequal, and then famously after you apply the taxes. By the way, Chile is improving faster than most of us because the enforcement of the system to collect taxes is better. So I'd say that the problem is that in some cases, in the most unequal societies, Teresa, the nominal and the disposable are practically, the same, or they maintain the same. So I think it suggests, policy-wise, of course, it suggests that we should do better in terms of the collection. The minimum wage and far too fast. Yes, you are right. I remember in Mexico, famously with López Portillo, this is even before De La Madrid, you know, a long time ago, suddenly one day they went very, very political, very populist, and said, increase the minimum wage, 10, 20, 30, because 10, 20, 30 is a different areas of Mexico. They had differentiated minimum wages. And, of course, the peso devalued, and there was capital outflight. People said they've gone crazy. They didn't care about the fact that even today, the minimum wage in Mexico is about maybe $150 a month, you know, something like that, maybe less. Now with the exchange rate at $15, maybe it's $120 or $130. It's $10 a day, not an hour, okay? It's minimum. But the problem is that for analytical purposes, it's not used as a wage. It's used as a unit. And it's indexed, and you do something wrong, you get penalized. You know, one month of minimum wages. You know, it's like for fines, or 1 week in jail or something like that. You know, it's in all the contracts. So it's very difficult to dismantle something like that, even if you have these minimum wages. But you can raise it too fast, or have the perception that you raise it too fast. When you have very low minimum wages, you are caught in a bind. Because if you raise it too fast, it looks like wages are going up, and they're not going up. It's just that part of the minimum, Now, what is the secret to a good minimum wage number? And that is that it should be at a distance enough from the average wage that it incentivates people to get new jobs, but it doesn't destroy jobs. Otherwise, if it's very close to the average wage, it will destroy jobs. And the reason is, why would you hire somebody who is new and with relatively low or little experience or no experience if it's going to cost you practically the same as an average worker? Then you hire somebody who has a lot more experience. And this conspires against those who are knocking on the door or kicking the door because they've been unemployed for 2 years or they got their diplomas, you know, and they were told that if they studied 2 or 3 years more, they'd get a job. And they are not getting jobs. And therefore, they become very frustrated and they go in the streets and they march and whatever. And then in the worst of these manifestations, I was recently in Tunisia. They got hundreds of thousands of people out of universities with diplomas unemployed. Guess which is the country that is feeding into Syria and the ISIS and all these systems more? Would you be surprised to say that it's Tunisia? You know, it follows, you know, it's related. I got into a very transcendental discussion. We were just talking about minimum wages and them going up too fast. But these are some of the informality. Will an increase in minimum wages breed more informality? Basically, when you're talking about $150 a month or $130 a month, that's not the point. That's not the point because people can't live on this kind of money. People don't make this kind of money. Actually, it's as I said, they go to informality because they're not being offered the minimum. And what is that? The type of protection that you seek? It's really. And what is the part that some of the employers want to avoid as costs? And that is why they say people are so poor, so desperate, they'll take anything you offer to them. But basically what they're trying to avoid is the part about Social Security, the part about sharing the profits, and the part about, you know, protecting them, and about going to court if you're fired summarily or arbitrarily or whatever. This is what they are trying to avoid. This is why you have to have a balance between the cost and the flexibility in the labor market and, of course, this minimum protection that we're seeking. States, not countries. Yes, but the problem is the nature of the legislation. Take minimum wages. You actually have minimum wages already in a number of states that are higher than the 725. In fact, the president went to 1010 for public servants because that's in the executive prerogative. The problem is, and a number of states are doing that already. And why? Because in a normal economic situation, even in a recovery situation, you're not going to be able to keep the workers if you're paying them 725 per hour. Somebody else is going to take them. And in the United States, famous for the mobility of its workers, they're going to move. In Europe, because of housing and a number of other things and cultural constraints and whatever, they stay, you know, they don't move. They become unemployed in a place, even if 200 miles away, there's a job. Yeah, they'll stay. But in the United States, you know, they move. They go and look for the jobs. And therefore, the market kind of clears. And then you do need, you need, so I think what is happening is, okay, the Congress doesn't want to legislate. States are doing that. And the market, in a way, is taking care of it to some extent. The only problem is this legislation is to protect the most vulnerable. And they're not always taken care of by the market or in the states or whatever. The most vulnerable normally remain very, very vulnerable. you know, in the outside of things. And that is why we need the legislation. This is the unskilled, the real victims of the crisis were young, male, unskilled. They're the ones that are still there, you know, they're still, and where the gap is growing. So they're the ones that we have to take care of.
Labor unions.
Yeah, I got this here, unionization. Imbalance of power. Yes, the PACs and this, you suggested the question of billions and no limits in terms of... we are looking at this from our point of view of governance and government, and in trying to analyze which is a better way to finance our own democracies. A comparative analysis. We're getting a lot of pushback, by the way. As you can imagine, it's not an enthusiastic, it's just like when we started looking at the health systems. And it's interesting because, of course, what you want to avoid is capture. And what you want to avoid is the inherent conflict of interest, and then the way in which a conflict of interest is addressed or elucidated or solved once you are in power and once you won with the support of whoever, you know, the powers that be. And then how do you compensate them or reward them for their support, either through public procurement or through some type of legislation or whatever? This is extremely, extremely important work. I have encouraged it. We've gotten into all sorts of hot water because of that. We were going to create a committee. We were going to create a working group. Now we created a network. Because who can object to a network? I mean, you're supposed to belong in a network because you want to, you know. But, you know, we can't do anything too institutional. And we're getting a kind of a coalition of the willing, if you will. People are kind of hiding in order to go to the meeting, you know, and using masks to go to the meetings. But this is big. This is big. You know, we're saying, okay, have less bureaucracy. You know, why did we take 3 days or 7 days or 30 days to approve how a company has to be registered? You know, this is the typical thing we do, you know, with the World Bank and with the IDB, you know, reduce the bureaucracy and the number of steps that you have to do and how much it costs to set up a company. But the problem is, how much does it cost to a society that they were captured before they even had a shot at it, by the powers that be? How does legislation get distorted? And how do the, how do these 1% and the 99 get maintained? How does one produce, a greener, but also a fairer type of society? So we're looking at some of the hardcore elements of society, and that is, now, unionization, I'll leave that for last. I was recently with Francis O'Grady, who is the head of the TUC, in London. And I said, well, look, the inclusive growth, you know, and the question of skills is critical, and we do this. And he said, have you looked at unionization? And I said, well, you know, inclusive growth and the skills and the education and the tax. He said, have you looked at unionization? No. He said, well, inclusive growth. He said, shut up. If you do not have a relationship between unionization and the drop in real wages and the drop in the share of wages in GDP in our countries, you're not doing your homework. This is not good. Go away. You know, something like that. Not quite, but... Mr. Trumka, you're Mr. Trumka. You're Mr. Trumka. Our Mr. Trumka. He's the chairman of our... BIAC and the TUAC system, the Trade Union Advisory Council, and we have a Business and Industry Advisory Council. he told us rather famously in a big debate we were having in public with 1,000 people there in front. He said, Mr. Gurria, are you the Monday OECD, which says that you are compassionate and you want a better distribution of income and you want better wages and the minimum wage? Or are you the Tuesday one, which says more labor flexibility, which means don't give them anything? Okay, that, of course, it was a bit of a caricature, but I think that, and then Frances, by the way, wrote to me after our meeting. I don't know if that she was a little worried that she had been maybe a little too rough. But then I wrote back just putting her mind at ease. Frankly, we believe that the question of being able to put forth more forcefully the voices of the workforce in a way which will produce a better dialogue, as I said, the trade unions, the private sector, the business sector, the governments, and the individual workers seems to be a better way than what we're seeing today. The secular drop in the wages in real terms, sometimes in nominal terms, cannot continue to be the way in which we adjust the economies, because there's coming to a point where it's not working. Domestic demand is not responding, and therefore you're having a missing element in the equation. So there you are. I think I got them all.
Thank you very much. Well, let's give a strong round of applause. Okay. This is a wonderful